creative journey. It's easy to get lost, but don't worry, you'll lift off. Sometimes you just need a creative pep talk.
Hey, you're listening to Creative Pep Talk, a weekly podcast companion for your creative journey. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. I'm a New York Times bestselling author and illustrator, and this show is where I share everything I'm learning about building and maintaining a thriving creative practice. Are you worried that you're lagging? Let's talk about how to lock in, reinvent, and recapture passion. This episode is for you if you feel like you're being left behind, if you feel like all the tech advancements and shifts in the past couple years have you scrambling, or you just feel like you're not locked into making progress in a meaningful direction that your whole heart and soul are behind. If you stay until the end, I'll come back with a call to adventure called the Heads Up 7 Seconds exercise that you can use today to make your creative session more aligned with where you are in this moment right now and make that effort count. But first, let's talk about the creative business that's going to put your business out of business if you play your cards right. I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it. Got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. If you're not witnessing massive disruptions in every creative field on the planet, you can't possibly be paying attention. Things have happened and changed so fast. So many happenings are happening in the world right now, whether it's how social media works or AI or social upheavals of so many kinds. Things have been really unstable for the past few years. And it can create so much anxiety around your creative practice, but it doesn't always have to. In fact, there may be a different way to approach this and think about this completely. And today on the show, I'm sharing a conversation I had with Josh Linkner. Josh is a jazz musician, author, and business person who is kind of also a legend in the public speaking sphere. So as most of you know, public speaking is a big part of what I do professionally, and it's a real creative passion of mine. So I discovered Josh through his podcast on public speaking called Mic Drop. It was while I was enjoying that show that I thought, hey, I need to go check out this person's books. He's got one called Big Little Breakthroughs, and Disciplined Dreaming is another one. And if you're a longtime listener, you know these titles speak to the same ideas that we talk about every single week on this show. But I also wanted to talk to Josh because in this season of high levels of disruption, I thought, who better to speak on this than the guy who literally wrote the book on reinvention? It's called The Road to Reinvention, and it's not about avoiding disruption, but driving it. This is what I think it means to be a creative person, and we talk about why that is and some tools for how to do this actively, happily, passionately, not begrudgingly, and not because you have to do this, but because you want to do this, because that's what being creative is all about. From what I can tell, you talk to a lot of business people, and a lot of what you talk to them about is creativity, and I've been reading your book, Big Little Breakthroughs, and it's great. It's got tons of incredible information on creativity, but it feels a little bit like it's targeted at people that maybe don't think of themselves as creative, and that's excellent, getting more people to be creative. But I was kind of struck by how bad creators maybe need to hear this information, because in my life and then in my experience and the people that I have met, creators of all kinds, we can get really stuck in our ways. We can get really superstitious or overly mystical about creativity. And so I feel like, man, this is a really, to get to like, what does the research say? Or what are some of the best practices we know work? I feel like they could really use it. So be gentle, because I'm a creator. You're a creative type. All my listeners are creators. But what do you think creative people get wrong about creativity now that you've learned so much about it? And is it different than what you see business people struggling with creatively? Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, a few things. First of all, the research, to answer your question, is crystal clear that all human beings are creative. And truthfully, any job title can be creative. We used to think, oh, the creatives, they sit on the second floor, you know, but the creatives should sit in every seat. And just because someone is in a traditionally, quote unquote, non-creative role like legal or tax, doesn't mean they can't be creative. Now, the first instinct is, oh, that means they're going to cook the books if they're an accountant. Of course not. They're going to use judgment and integrity, but they can find creative ways even in something that seems uncreative. By the way, there are people in quote-unquote creative fields that are not that creative. If I know classical musicians that are fabulous technicians, and they maybe interpret a Mozart sonata, but they're really not creating much of anything that's not new. So I think the first thing we need to do is remove the notion that some titles are creative and others are not, and that some people are creative and others not. Because the truth is, we're all creative, regardless of what role or station in life we find ourselves in. There's always room to express creativity. So then the question you asked was, what can creatives do, and when do they get stuck? Again, anchoring back to that we're all creative, I think that we can get stuck in our ways. You know, like I play jazz, and jazz is a very fluid art form. And I've been performing for 40 years, played over 1,000 concerts around the world. And even in jazz, sometimes you're like, oh, there's a pattern that I know. This is going to work really well. I know this chord voicing on this particular song. And what happens is that once something works, the human mind tends to anchor in it's based on historical reference. And so I think what we have to do as creatives is keep pushing ourselves to try that like something new and to arrest the pattern instead of rely on the pattern. And so the same spirit that got us in that creative chair in the first place sometimes can dwindle. Just because our mind is based on pattern recognition and we kind of know what already works, quote unquote. And it's the act of not knowing, the act of remaining as curious as you were the first time you picked up a paintbrush or a musical instrument. That's what keeps the creativity rolling.
Yeah, that's great. And it gets right to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, because I find that there's two pieces when you're trying to build a creative practice. There's two things that feel at odds sometimes. And one is, you know, creativity is often about like doing something that's never been done. And for a business to work, you really have to have systems of like, hey, we can predict this at least for some amount of time. We know this thing works and we need to keep this thing going. But you talked about having space to kind of reinvent or break the pattern. And I love in your book, the whole section about opening a test kitchen. Now, you're not saying we should all get into the food industry, but can you tell us a little bit about that idea?
Yeah. I mean, the best creative people in all walks of life, business and art alike, are the best experimenters. And the notion of we should always really be running an experiment. And in a test kitchen, in a food environment, think about a test kitchen as it's a safe environment. They've got like ingredients and stoves and such. And it's an opportunity for them to tinker while they're not trying to serve the main dish on a busy Saturday night. And it's that both psychological safety that occurs, and also the assets, it allows people to really push the creative boundaries. And the reason I wrote a chapter on it is I think it's something we can put in our own lives, regardless of our vocation. You know, if you're an illustrator, why not have a little time set aside where it's your test kitchen time? And you're not cranking out a new design for a paying client on a deadline. It's like, you know, an hour here or there where you can like doodle and imagine and push the boundaries and try something that you've never tried before. And I find that if we invest that little bit of time, doesn't have to be a lot, that test kitchen mentality, it really pushes the creative boundaries and keeps us fresh. And by the way, even when you're working on a project on a deadline, you know, there is still room for that. You know, maybe what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to present, you know, one alternative to the client, and that's the one that I know that they want, and it's based on, you know, what I've, my previous work. And then I'm going to draw one as if I'm a totally different type of artist. If your style is X, maybe you say, what's the opposite of X? What if I tried it that way? Now, if you always anchor to one color palette, try the opposite color palette. And you know, just the notion of pushing yourself to try something new and, you know, show the client. And my hunch is that you might be surprised which one they choose.
Yeah. And I love the example you have in the book from Shake Shack, which I didn't really know the origins of. Could you share that study a little bit, that case study that you use in the book?
Yeah, so Danny Meyer is a brilliant restaurateur, and he's very high-end restaurants in New York and elsewhere. But he started this idea of Shake Shack, which originally was, I think it was started maybe with hot dogs too, and it kind of expanded to hamburgers. And it's, you know, the menu is pretty simple, like, you know, good old-fashioned American comfort food. But underneath the restaurant in New York, and I think it's in, it might be in Chelsea, or maybe it's in the South Village. But anyway, There's a restaurant on top, and underneath it's the Shake Shack Innovation Kitchen. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a test kitchen. And so down there, they're trying crazy weird stuff. Like, oh, what if we put this weird zucchini sauce on it? What if we did candied bacon? You know, and they're always trying new things. And then the cool part is that they're actually close to the customer. It's one thing if you did this in, you know, in a rural farm in the middle of Alaska, but like they're right there with the customer. So they can create little ideas, run upstairs, let people try it, go back and forth. So I like the fact that number one, they're tinkering and it's in a separate environment. So they can still deliver upstairs what they got to do to ring the register, but they've created a safe space for tinkering. But then also the proximity of customer access is cool because they get this sort of ongoing feedback loop. And of course, it doesn't have to be just in restaurants. I mean, we can apply that in any domain.
I love it because it's a different perspective on something that I've explored a lot on the show through a different lens. I usually talk about it through the lens of stand-up comedy and what they call writing on stage. And I'm so fascinated by them working out stuff in the club, even getting people to lock up their phones. Like, I have pushed creators, like, always have that space. You know, I make episode art every week for my podcast. And I don't know if that's financially a great use of my time, but it's where all my new ideas and all my fresh material come out. And it kind of also is similar to things I see where I see bands that have these side projects that unlock all this stuff. I was just listening to, I don't know if you're familiar with Ben Gibbard from Death Cab and Postal Service, but this side band Postal Service unlocked his main band's favorite album. And I just kind of wish that I could go talk to him and be like, start more side bands, man. You didn't have to just leave that in 2004. Like, keep doing it. Because I think I agree. You need that creative space. Do you have, what does that space look like in your own business and creative output?
Well, one fun thing is, you know, it doesn't have to be a physical space, depending on your career. But you know, I feel like most of the time that we do professionally is what you might define as heads down time. On a deadline, crank it out, get your to-do list done. And the problem, even just think about physically, you're looking heads down. By definition, you're not heads up. And when you're heads up, you notice things and you're experimenting and you're tinkering. So I encourage people to carve out a little heads up time and really protect it like it's an important thing. And actually, here's a fun challenge I've issued to thousands of people around the world. I say, give yourself an experiment, back to this notion of experimentation, run a 30-day experiment. If you take a look at someone's 40-hour work week, 5% of that is 2 hours a week. So you say, I'm going to take a 5% 30-day experiment where the other 95% of your time, you know, you do what you normally do, but that 2%, it could be if a two-hour block, it could be 4 30-minute blocks, whatever feels right to you, but carve it out and protect that time for heads up time where there's not a deliverable. It's room to breathe creatively and to explore and to like tinker and such. And anyway, here's what I hear back. I've done this hundreds of times. First thing I hear back is 0% drop in productivity, zero. Magically, 40 hours gets smushed into 38 hours, no one misses a beat. Second thing I hear back is that the first week or so, people feel really frivolous. They're like, oh man, I hope my boss doesn't catch me. It's almost like you're ashamed, like you're cheating on your spouse or something. Like, oh my God, I'm not doing something productive. But by the end of that 30 days, people say it's the most productive time they've spent in years. And many have adopted that as an ongoing process. So I think like anything in life, you know, you have to carve out time and resources for things that matter. And if you're in the creative field, and again, I hope everybody is, yeah, what an important thing to do to sharpen the saw, to push the boundaries, to try new things.
And knowing that you have a pretty serious background in jazz, I really like jazz. I'm not, I don't have any expert knowledge around it, but I am a fan. And it seems like almost like, depending on how experimental we're talking, there seems to be that space built into a jazz song where you have maybe, here's like the chords and the thing that we're trying to get across with the song, but we always have sections or instruments that are doing the test kitchen thing in real time. Is that, do you think that's just kind of impacted the way you move through your own work?
Yeah, man. I think of myself as a jazz musician first. And the way I do business and stuff is just jazz. And I'll unpack that a little bit. So jazz, not everyone loves it, which I understand, an acquired taste. But it's first of all, it's the only art form that I know of where you're composing and performing in real time. So you can't just like go back and correct a mistake. You know, you're in it in front of a discerning audience. The other thing, jazz is much more like a conversation. Like you and I aren't reading from a script. You say something, I build off of it, vice versa. We're listening, we're responding. And if we got together tomorrow, it would be a slightly different conversation, even if it was on a similar topic. And so what jazz is, it's a loose framework. There's almost like topics. And even if we played in the same band every night for 10 years in a row, every night would be different. Every song would be different because it really is like a musical conversation. And in jazz, what you're trying to do is you're taking your own artistic expression, but you're also, if there's co-creation. So you might start a little riff on the drums and I might pick up on a guitar and someone else takes it on the sax. And so it's not just individual artistic expression. It's collective. It's collaborative expression, which makes it even more cool and fascinating and fun and dangerous and all that. And so, yeah, it's deeply affected me in a lot of ways. One is the way I think about risk taking. So if you're playing jazz and you play a really bad note, yeah, play it twice more and call it art. Everything's cool. But kidding aside, like the jazz combo, the cultural attributes of that team support creative risk taking rather than punch you in the face if you make a mistake. And so like there's a lot of metaphors that can be drawn from. And I think now today more than ever, we all kind of got to play some jazz. I mean, what jazz musicians do when you put the music aside, they use situational awareness, active listening. They adapt to changing conditions. They have to course correct and deal with mistakes quickly. They have to improvise to deliver the best outcome. And whether you're an illustrator or a lawyer or do interpretive dance, like we're all playing jazz these days to a degree. And I to me, it's been a wonderful training ground.
Couldn't be more relevant in this moment because I know the creative industry especially has just had so much disruption over the past couple of years, and it just seems to be ramping up. I think lots of industries are seeing this, but creatives, I think, especially are feeling some serious tension. You literally wrote the book on reinvention, and I wondered, I was going to pick your brain on this because I think everybody is having to, as you say, play some jazz and figure out how are we going to reinvent and move forward. What are any pieces of, maybe what's a piece from the book that has stuck with you that you maybe still think about and utilize when it comes to maintaining that kind of agility in your practice?
Yeah, I think a lot of times people think about a word like reinvention as a one-time event that happens, you know, once a decade or something like that. And what I try to drive home in the book is that actually it's better off as an ongoing process. Like in theory, you should always be in sort of a state of reinvention, the way you're always growing and learning and evolving as a human being. And it's funny, I had a saying as I built my several businesses. I said it so often, man, my people got sick of hearing it. But the phrase was, someday a company will come along and put us out of business. So it might as well be us. And I adopt that same approach, both as a human and also as a creative person. Like the notion that someone's going to come along and put me out of business might as well be me. Which is kind of cool because then you're always like, okay, what's my next version going to look like? And I'll tell you why it's kind of freeing. On the one hand, you can say, well, that's kind of scary. Oh my gosh. But on the other hand, it means that nothing you do has to have some crazy level of permanence. So that's actually kind of a freeing concept. I mean, you're always this evolving work of art and you get to play around and test and take risks and all that. That's kind of freeing. And the notion that if you're in a rough patch, it doesn't have to stay that way. Or by the way, even if you're in a success patch, don't take it for granted. And so it's a really healthy approach, I think, not to be scared of that next version, but to be excited about it and lean into it. And that's the best advice that I can give is you sort of like put yourself in this ongoing state of reinvention. It's less risky than one big one once a decade, and it's way more effective.
I also think the reframe from I'm reinventing because I'm afraid to I'm reinventing because that's what I do. That's what's exciting. I did a talk to a group of designers not long ago. They were doing this retreat, and I was sensing when I was prepping, like, they're worried about how their businesses are changing. And I came into that space thinking, hey, you wanted to be creative for a living because you didn't want to do the same thing all the time. And now you're getting frustrated that you have to change what you do. Like, this is your game. Like, there's just a reframe there of, like, the whole idea is that it's exciting to constantly reinvent. And I love the spin that you put on that.
Yeah, thanks, man. And it really is, you know, if you think about the great artists of the world, whether they're a comedian or a painter, you know, Picasso didn't have one phase, he had multiple phases. You know, great comedians are constantly redoing their material, as you point out. One of my heroes, Miles Davis, was at the forefront of no fewer than four completely transformative genres of jazz. And so the prolific ones, the legendary artists, are the one that actually, not that they cling to only one thing, like one hit wonder, but they're always pushing the creative boundaries and trying something new. And by the way, it doesn't always work. Like one of my other jazz heroes is John Coltrane. And he made, you know, Love Supreme was one of the most incredible albums of the universe. And so was Giant Steps. And some of his later work, I didn't really like that much, nor did a lot of other people. It was almost pushed a little far for many people's ears, but good for him for doing that, you know? And so I love the notion that even as an artist, it doesn't have to mean like everything is perfect and every album's got to be better than the one before, but at least giving ourselves a little grace and permission to push the creative boundaries and try something new.
I love that. My oldest daughter, she's Gen Z, and I love Gen Z. Honestly, like I feel like these are good people that are coming up in a bunch of ways, to overgeneralize a generation. But one of the things that I think is permeating the culture and it's impacting creators is this idea of things being cringe. And it kind of worries me because I think there's a pressure for creators to have this flawless career, where they don't have any of those albums that were like cringe, like they were bad, like that, we didn't like that. But the people that have had these long-term careers, they have those, like Bob Dylan has cringe albums. Like, and I think you're absolutely right. You have to let the journey not be a masterpiece, I think. You have to let it have some rough patches, you know?
I'm so glad you said that because, you know, someone looking at you and your incredible work, they might say everything he touches is beautiful, it's masterful, it's his God-given talent, you know? And my experience is that, you know, when you look at, like, even a Picasso where there's, you know, 15 paintings that are really famous, he created 150,000 pieces of art. You know, so like if you're unwilling to have cringe, you're unwilling to be an artist. If you're unwilling to have cringe, you're unwilling to be an innovator. And the notion is that, you know, sometimes it takes some quote unquote cringe to connect the dots and let your art unfold. And so I think it's crucial. Like, in fact, we should probably aim for more cringe. Like the right ratio of awesome to cringe is not, you know, it's not a zero. Like there's got to be some good cringe to get the art right.
Okay, I want to leave you with a little call to adventure, a call to action to put some of these ideas into your practice right now. This one is called the Heads Up 7 Seconds exercise to get tuned in, locked in for a more mindful connection to what you're doing. So I don't know about you, but I'm strapped for time. Like, I have 3 kids, I've got 2 dogs, I've got a mortgage, I've got 4 creative practices. And so when I go to create something, I can just so easily just swoop it, jump straight in, cannonball into my process. And what ends up happening is I'm not tuned in. I haven't dropped in. I'm not there. I don't know where I am. I don't know if I'm in the last activity or if I'm somewhere in the future, but I'm not there making the work. And so one of the things I've been trying to do as I sit down, especially when I go to write in the morning, I write almost every morning, and I've been trying to do this thing, and I'm calling it the Heads Up 7 Seconds exercise because it's really fast. It's not going to take any time at all. It's just 3 seconds inhale, hold it for 1 second, 3 second exhale. It's just a little tiny controlled breathing exercise. And the purpose of it is to drop you in to the moment, to where you are, so that what you're making and what you're doing is related to where you actually are and where you actually want to go next. And this simple thing, it might not seem like anything, but it's been a pretty important part of my practice recently, because I can get through a portion of creating a writing session or a drawing session, realize I've just been spending the past hour like frantically running in 18 directions and literally not leaving where I started in any meaningful way. And so every time I sit down for the past month or so, let's say, I will stop, I will pause, I will just do a little breathing, look at my surroundings, feel what I'm feeling, and tune into, where am I? What does this need to be? What does this piece, how can I get my mind into the moment? And I do the same thing when I go on stage to do a talk, because for me, I've found that every single talk, I need about 7 seconds. I need about 15 seconds at the start to pause, breathe, be in that moment, and then communicate. I even leave a little space at the beginning of every talk to communicate a feeling that I'm feeling right there in that moment. And I can't decide what I'm going to say until I'm there, so that it's connected exactly to the moment that I'm in. And so that's what I want you to do. I want you to take 7 seconds, do controlled breathing, and just identify one feeling that you're having right now. And once you acknowledge it and you're mindful about, this is who I am right now, this is where I am right now, you're going to be able to more actively put your real self, who you are right now, into the work, because who you are and what you're doing and where you're at all meet in the moment by tuning in like this. And so that's your exercise to do what Josh talked about. Don't just put your head down and start working. Have a moment of heads up time. Take it in, soak it in, tune in before you cannonball in to your process. I want to thank Josh Linkner for having this conversation with me. I know he's a super busy guy. He's very in demand in the public speaking business space. And I was excited to kind of do something differently. We usually have creators talk about business and practice and all that kind of thing. And I know this guy, his main background is in jazz music, but then he got into the business world, investing, all that kind of stuff, and spends most of his time talking to business people about creativity. And I thought, could be cool to flip it, give us a taste of something different. And I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope it got you thinking about embracing reinvention instead of fearing the need to reinvent. Creative Pep Talk is your weekly podcast companion for your creative journey. And hey, it's dangerous to go alone. If you're looking for a little creative community and accountability, we do a monthly live Zoom call with our paid Substack subscribers. You can sign up and join us at andyjpizza.substack.com, or sign up to our free newsletter so that you never miss a week of this podcast or a week of pushing your creative practice forward. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. I'm a New York Times bestselling author and illustrator. I do client work for the likes of Apple, Xbox, and Lego, and I travel the world pep talking teams at creative hubs like Warby Parker and Sesame Street. You can reach out about commissions and collaborations at andyjpizza.com. Massive thanks to our backers, Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme song and soundtrack, to Sophie Miller for content support. And until we speak again, stay pepped up.